Live from Studio S, Alex Mendenhall, our featured performer here today on a Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. More from Alex throughout the course of the hour and lots more here on a very busy Friday here on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Of course, the drama surrounding the removal of State Representatives Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat dragged through yesterday afternoon and into this morning as the two Michigan lawmakers fought to keep their jobs. Corser and Gamrat were the central players in a sex and cover-up scandal that's roiled the state capitol for many weeks now. They are, of course, both gone now. Gamrat expelled, Corser resigned. For the latest on this story, we go to the Detroit News' Chad Livengood, who is in a rather sleep-deprived state, but nonetheless joins us here this morning. We appreciate it, Chad.
I am present, Mark.
We also have on the line from downtown Lansing another sleep-deprived human being who was up all night, and will also shed some light on this situation here, Rick Pluta from the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Rick.
Hi, guys.
Hey, let's walk through this chronologically as best we can, because an awful lot has happened here since our listeners may have last visited this story. Rick, can you revisit for us what happened yesterday? Let's say prior to midnight. How did the workday end, for example, or how did things look last evening after all was said and done?
Well, look, yesterday began with the committee that was, you know, looking into the ability of Corser and Gamrat to serve kicking out on a party line vote, which is not the way that it was supposed to happen. The resolutions to expel them both, despite the recommendation of the House legal counsel that Gamrat be censured and Corser be expelled. And that just kind of set up for a whole day of maneuvering and even, you know, some bickering about what was going to happen. And so by the time it all played out until, you know, even the end of the evening, you know, the midnight, say, that we had a situation where Democrats were complaining about the process. And so these two Tea Party Republicans, their biggest allies in this, were Democrats who said, look, we don't think this was fair because we think that House Speaker Kevin Cotter hasn't, his role hasn't been fully explored. And so we're not going to vote for expulsion until we see some action on that. And that led to the stalemate that just dragged it out through the afternoon into the night and, you know, the early hours of this morning.
And now it appears there will be an investigation by the state police into whether or not there was any criminal wrongdoing by Gamrat and Corser. Let's turn to Chad Livengood for his thoughts on that. Put that in perspective
for us. We'll find out just how broad and open there is this investigation ends up being. The state police are already doing an investigation followed on a complaint by Representative Corser that he was somehow extorted at some point or attempted to be extorted to resign or by some anonymous text messenger who was threatening to expose their affair back in May. And he claims that this is all his defense for why he set off this ruse, this controlled burn email, as he called it, setting up this spreading this story around Lansing that he was caught having sex with a male prostitute, and this is essentially the email that undid him. And so now the state police are going to now investigate maybe malfeasance in office. And we're not sure exactly what that's going to really amount to, but it was done to try to appease the Democrats that there was going to be another outside review of some sort of this. And Democrats see an opportunity to keep this story alive in some ways, mm-hmm. and specifically the role of the Speaker of the House and his central staff.
But was further investigation here, ongoing investigation, part of what got the Democrats to reach consensus with the House leadership, Rick?
Well, I think it was at the very least, the opportunity after a long night and morning of stalemate to be able to say that they somehow moved the ball on this. You know, the difference between where things stood before and after is that the Democrats will say now the state police and the attorney general's office will be handed all of the unredacted the unredacted version of the House Business Office inquiry, and not the public version that has a lot of things scrubbed from it in order to look into it. But, you know, referring something to the state police and referring something to the attorney general's office doesn't mean that there's going to be an investigation or a deeper dive. It just means that they're going to get this stuff and they will make a decision on what to do with it.
Rick, you spoke with State Representative Todd Corser after his decision to resign. Let's listen to a part of Representative Corser's comments.
You know, it's an unfortunate chapter where we're at, you know, obviously for the State House and for the state and for the legislature, for my own family, and it's time to turn a page and take a step forward and go in a different direction.
Chad Livengood, was it becoming clear that Cindy Gamrat would be expelled likely and that it couldn't be good for him? Was that part of the landscape
here?
Well,
I think coming into this last night, people thought it would be the other way around, that Cindy Gamrat would not want to become the first woman female legislator to be expelled and would want to essentially save face and resign. And everyone thought that Corser, the defiant, self-described gladiator, would fight to the end. I mean, I have a text message that he sent one of his former aides when he was being advised to resign in May and basically confess to the affair or just at least resign and go away quietly. And he said, no, I don't think that's how I want to do it. I think a crucifixion is in order. And everyone thought that Todd Corser was going to just take it all the way to the end and literally have to be dragged out of the house.
Yeah.
Kicking and screaming.
Rick, how did the legislature come to the decision to expel Gamrat as opposed to simply censure her?
Well, I think part of what happened was that Todd Corser got up and testified before the committee, raised some questions about who knew what and when, really about how forthcoming Representative Gamrat had been with the with the committee, and I guess maybe there were some communications between the two of them that they found troubling, and so the committee decided that instead of going down the path of censure, which, like Chad said, seemed to be the direction that this was taking, that they were going to go for just expulsion for the two of them. And in the end, it seems like Cindy Gamrat felt like sort of an agreement had been made and violated, and so if she was going to go, she was going to make them vote to do it.
To this issue of this agreement, her attorney went in and negotiated some type of a letter that she was going to sign, and offering essentially a confession that she would offer to the committee and ask for their censure of her. Mm-hmm. The committee chairman met with Representative Gamrat late Monday night. Representative Ed McBroom. He lives in Dickinson County, and he had to drive 8 hours on Labor Day to get down to the Capitol to meet with her late at night. And he told her specifically, I can't make any guarantees. I can't tell the other 107 members how to vote. I'm going to, take this under advisement. And they seemed like they were going to go down this route on Tuesday. And then they had a caucus meeting midday Tuesday. And there were some senior Republican members who were very upset with the idea of letting Cindy Gamrat sort of skate for this and then try and take out Todd Corser. For a lot of Republicans who have been dealing with their behavior all year long, it was an all-or-nothing proposition.
Chad, you are here right after an appearance on Off the Record on Michigan Public Television. One of your fellow panelists on Off the Record, which will be seen later today on WKAR-TV and at WKAR.org, one of your fellow panelists, Bill Ballinger, claimed on Off the Record that Democrats were on a fishing expedition. They wanted to link Corser and Gamrat to Speaker Kevin Cotter. Is there anything to that? What do you make of that assessment?
Well, they were trying to link whether the former aides had come to Cotter and his staff, specifically the former chief of staff, Norm Saari, and confided anything more than that's what's already publicly known, as far in terms of what they expressed concern about this, the affair, the relationship, the closer than usual relationship that Representative Corser and Gamrat were carrying on in this combined office, which was unusual to begin with. And so they were looking for things to try to essentially show that there was some type of effort here in this whole process to sort of sweep under the rug what did the Republican majority speaker and his staff know, and when did they know it.
Rick, how close did Cindy Gamrat come to resigning before the expulsion? Is that known?
We know that it had been very touch and go with her, that she talked about resigning several times. And I heard from both her and her attorney that her family played heavily into this, that they were pressing her, not to quit and not to walk out. And you know, she said that in her speech on the floor, that resigning would have been easier, but her family urged her to take a different path.
Look, Chad, let's try to look down the road a little bit here and get away from all the drama of just the last few hours. First of all, how will Corser and Gamrat's replacements be chosen?
Well, the governor will, Governor Snyder will be able to call a special election if he wants on a special day for a primary, or they can use the elections that are on the calendar, which would be next March during the presidential primary. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have a primary then, and then you'd have a general election in May. Or they can try to speed it up and have a primary beforehand. It's too late to get on the November ballot. So there will be special elections. These are pretty rock-rib Republican districts, so the Republicans aren't in any immediate known danger of losing them, although I wouldn't be surprised if the Democrat who Todd Corser faced last year tries again for the seat. So there's going to be components of that that will go on.
Rick, any response from
that? Legally, Corser and Gamrat would be eligible to run in those elections if they desired.
Oh my!
It's happened before, right?
How about that? Any response from the governor's office that you've heard, Rick or Chad? Rick.
The governor's office, put out a statement saying that they supported the call for a state police investigation just a few minutes ago. The attorney general put out a statement saying that actually they already had an investigation open into this matter. They've already been in discussions with the state police on that, and that they say they're going to do a quote complete and thorough without fear or favor inquiry into this.
There's another component that will probably come forward at some point down the road, and that is maybe a potential civil lawsuit against the House.
Oh, yeah.
By the former employees, Ben Graham and Keith Howard, who were fired in early July because they have basically sort of claimed the wrongful termination. Now, the House Business Office in its investigation essentially declared itself not guilty and said that it followed all the laws, and that they also declared unilaterally that there's no whistleblower lawsuit here. There will probably be a judge at some point who decides whether these two men qualify as whistleblowers. And that could be another point of juncture where Speaker Cotter and his staff get pulled into some kind of deposition, and the Democrats may again someday find some interesting material out of this whole saga that they can use against him.
Rick Pluta,
why I think the House will wind up settling this rather than risking discovery.
Rick, will we look back on this as more or less a sideshow, or could serious reforms come from this chapter?
I don't know what what reforms you might see coming out of this. That it was certainly a circus, and we should also throw some props to Chad. He is the person who broke this story.
I wanted to wrap up on this note, Chad. You essentially broke this story. You actually became a part of the story, at least temporarily. Clarify where that stands for us. Is your involvement in this story, aside from your role as a reporter, over with?
I can say unequivocally that I never sent blackmail text messages to Representative Todd Corser or Cindy Gamrat. I simply was approached by two people who had an audio tape of Todd Corser talking about some pretty bizarre plan to smear himself in an attempt to cover up his affair with Representative Gamrat. I hadn't even really given those two much thought until mid-July when I obtained this audio tape, and it kind of took over my summer from there.
We want to thank both of our Capitol reporters, Chad Livengood of the Detroit News, Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network, here explaining as best they can where we stand today after the expulsion of State Rep. Cindy Gamrat and the resignation of State Representative Todd Corser. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Chad.
You bet.
It's getting late, you finally make it home. I see your face and out of space alone. You know I know I'm not the only one to sing to you after the setting sun. You seem to go from high to low so fast, and though you glow, it's not your own you cast. I stay awake until it's dark outside, and it's like you even push and pull the tides. Well, there's so many stars and you so many scars, but something about you makes you best by far. And all through the night, well, you climb to new heights, still holding my heart, 'cause you're my favorite light. Well, do you know that down below I'm yours? Long ago, well, there were so many more who used your light to get them through till dawn. Needed your presence long after you'd gone. Well, there's so many stars, and you so many scars, but something about you makes you best by far. And all through the night, well, you climb to new heights, still holding my heart, 'cause you're my favorite light. Sometimes you feel so far away, and you call it apogee, but even then I'm still caught up in your gravity. There's so many stars, you so many scars.
Alex Mendenhall, live in Studio S from WKAR's Live Music Friday here on Current State. It's called Song for the Moon. More live music and conversation with Alex Mendenhall coming up in just a little bit here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us today. In the top 100 highest grossing films of 2014, women represented a total of only 30% of all speaking characters, according to data. And of that group, only 26% were women of color. A group of creative social justice activists based in West Michigan has set out to change on-screen perception of women and other underrepresented groups in the media. They've done that by starting the Grand Rapids Feminist Film Festival. The festival is happening this weekend, and speaking with us today from Grand Rapids is festival organizer Lydia Van Hoven. Lydia, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The Grand Rapids Film Festival, Feminist Film Festival, is the brainchild of the Bandit Zine. Explain what a zine is and explain what the Bandit Zine is all about.
Sure, yeah. A zine is like a magazine, but it's a self-published type of publication where it's put out by usually a radical group. There's a whole kind of zine culture, and the Bandit Zine is what they call a comp zine, so meaning a compilation zine. And we focus on social justice topics, so we put out a call for submissions on a subject that's something like, you know, feminism or sizism. We've done issues on rape culture, things like that that are really pertinent and important in today's culture. And then we take all of these submissions that we get, we put the best ones into our zine and curate it into this really nice magazine that we give out for free.
And the Bandit Zine, I understand, is dedicated to fighting isms. Is that right? What does that mean?
Sure, yeah. It's just a nice way to say, really, that we're dedicated to fighting things like sexism, were things like sizism and things like racism and other really, really important topics that need to be talked about that often aren't talked about, especially for marginalized people.
Well, feminism is one of the world's most established isms. I'm going to assume that's an acceptable ism for you.
Yes, that's an ism we like, for
okay,
sure.
Okay, no, that's a good ism.
Yeah.
You're featuring around 40 different films at your film festival, which is quite a few. Do you have one that stood out or really spoke to you this year?
Yeah, it's hard. We got over 1,000 submissions, so it's really hard for me to pick one that I love, but there is this one that's called Disruptions, and it's a dance-on-camera piece. And this is a six-minute film about a woman who kind of makes this beautiful modern dance in front of the wall at Israel and Palestine. Mm. And then at the end of the film, it becomes really like the reality of what's happening in those countries, and she has to leave because of the police.
Lydia Van Hoven is the organizer of the Grand Rapids Feminist Film Festival, which takes place here this weekend. We have a short clip from another one of the films called The Red Thunder. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Sure, yeah. The Red Thunder is a Hollywood film through and through. So a lot of our films are things that are kind of more low budget, but this one is definitely a high budget film, and it's has actors from Weeds and Parenthood in it, and it's all about, it's kind of like Hollywood does feminism, right? They do a feminist film, and it's about a woman that is the Red Thunder, and she's a superhero. So it's just a very high-budget kind of Marvel-esque film.
Do you like it? What do you make of Hollywood's take on feminism?
It's not as radical as the Bandit. You know, our feminism is very intersectional, including all types of people. You know, the people of color, including the LGBT and queer groups. But this one is a very white film. But it's great to kind of see how Hollywood does the feminist film.
Let's listen to a clip from the trailer. We're gonna hear the mother and the daughter here in a film called The Red Thunder.
Mom, I need a favor.
I use my car for work, and if there's an emergency...
What kind of emergency is there going to be? You're a podiatrist.
Oh, there's a big whoosh boom. I know it's a Hollywood production, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
You also have a block of films that you've labeled as kid-friendly. Why did you want to include some films that were targeted toward a younger audience?
We think it's very important for kids and to be exposed to films that feature these marginalized people and show them what film and media could really look like versus what they are seeing on TV. And these films, it's a block from 12:30 to about 1:45, and it's 13 films that are all, you know, not just animations, but things like that dance piece is included. So things that are not, don't have trigger warnings and aren't going to be scary or don't have, you know, adult themes in them.
Is feminism addressed in these kid-friendly films?
Yeah, some of them are very feminist. Some of them
How exactly? How does feminism get addressed in a kid-friendly film?
Sure. I think we talk a lot about how making a film as a marginalized person, as a woman, or as like a queer person, is a feminist act in and of itself. So a lot of those are that type of thing. But we have one, this music video called Girls Don't Cry Wolf, and it actually was done locally, and it's about victims of sexual assault, but it's wrapped in this music video and deals with kind of slut shaming and victim blaming and other things like that, but in a very kind of kid-friendly way.
Hmm. And it works. You like the way they go about this?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I love it. I think it's totally smart and a great way to show kids and adults an entertaining side of this feminism. I mean, when you think of a feminist film, you think it's going to be a dry documentary or you think it's going to be something that's, you know, very heavy, but it doesn't have to be.
Mm. We have a clip from one of these kid-friendly films. It's called Bay Area Girls Rock Camp. This is a documentary about a music camp for girls. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, we actually have one in Grand Rapids, too, called Grand Rapids Girls Rock, and they're doing it in the Bay Area. It's a national thing. And this film features these little girls that are all making music, and they go to this camp for a week and learn how to be in a band. And so they, you know, it's the drummers or it's the lead singer, and it's all a whole group of older girls that kind of mentor them to become rock stars.
Here's a little clip of one of the girls talking about her band in the documentary.
We just keep playing over and over again something that we do in our band, so we get really, really good. And then you get comfortable with it, and then you start knowing how to play it.
That's adorable.
It is adorable.
Alongside the films, Lydia, you're also hosting a series of panels and workshops at the festival. Can you tell us about some of the issues you'll be discussing in those?
Sure, yeah. We're hosting panels in the, so we're at Wealthy Theater, and we're in the smaller micro cinema called the Koning Theater, and we'll be hosting panels all day from eight different ones from 12:30 to 7:45 p.m., and a few of the panels are, we're doing one called, we're calling Working Girl, and it's about navigating male-dominated careers. So we have people like someone that's a rapper, Lady Ace Boogie, who's a local rapper. We have someone that is a sex worker. We have someone that's a welder. We have a video producer, obviously very closely tied to the film, and then someone who's an advertising copywriter. We're also doing one called, we're calling Talk Nerdy to Me, and this is about forming feminist spaces in geek culture. This is presented by Vault of Midnight, which is a comic book shop in Ann Arbor and Grand Rapids. And we're having some national comic book artists come in and the founder of Girls Don't Read Comics, GR, and then also a video game reviewer to kind of talk about the geek culture and really why you need to be proud of being a woman in geek culture.
We have less than a minute, but I have to ask you, is feminism changing? And specifically, what's the conversation like when a younger feminist discusses feminism with an older feminist? Is there agreement or is there a lot of disagreement in 2015? How does that unfold?
I think the basic ideologies of feminism are remaining the same, but as our landscape changes, I definitely think that the newer feminists are becoming more intersectional, meaning that they're including the black feminists, they're including the queer feminists, the trans, the gay and the lesbian. It's all different groups. You know, it's not just a skinny white woman as a feminist. It's these all like a varied group of people.
We've been talking to Lydia Van Hoven, organizer of the Grand Rapids Feminist Film Festival, which is this weekend. For more information, there must be a website to go to. Lydia, what is it?
There is. It's grfff.org.
Lydia, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alex Mendenhall performing live in Studio S here on WKAR's Current State on a Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. On September 11th, 2001, emergency room physician Dr. Antonio Daher reported for his shift at what's now called New York Presbyterian Lower Manhattan Hospital, five blocks from ground zero, of course, for millions of us, the dreadful images of the burning and collapsing Twin Towers back on 9/11/01 are engraved in our memories. Dr. Daher was just five blocks away from the falling World Trade Center. With scant moments to prepare, hundreds of wounded victims are flooding into your workspace, and you're in charge of their care.
Clogged roads and jammed radios prevented ambulances getting to most of the city's hospitals. However, there was one tiny community hospital, the closest to the Twin Towers, called Downtown. It was soon in the thick of the action and unexpectedly became the epicenter of the medical emergency.
You have a sense of what your hospital's capacity is or how many patients you can see an hour. And this was light speed. This was warp speed for everybody.
That was a short clip from a UK Channel 4 documentary on 9/11 produced 10 years after the tragedy. The man you just heard describing that hospital scene is our first guest. Dr. Tony Daher is the director of emergency medicine at New York Presbyterian Lower Manhattan Hospital, and he is in our studio today. He's the keynote speaker at the Sparrow Foundation's annual Kaleidoscope Conference at the Kellogg Center at MSU. Dr. Daher, welcome to Current State.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
How many patients did you treat on 9/11?
I think overall that day we treated over 1,000. In the first hour in the emergency department, somewhere around 300.
And how long did your team continue to treat them?
We stayed overnight. We went down to the site that evening to help as well, right at the World Trade Center.
What types of injuries did your patients have?
The first patients we got were victims of severe burns and falling debris. When the towers were hit, a lot of, as you might imagine, a lot of building material came off them and struck pedestrians below. So a lot of very bad head injuries. The jet fuel, in a very bizarre way, because of where the plane hit the first tower, the fuel went down the elevator shafts and all the way to the floor lobby and blew out the doors there and burned people very severely in the lobby.
Did you have any sense of your patient's survival rate?
Yes, we tracked all our cases. Again, it depends. Of our critically injured patients, those who were expected to survive based on their initial injuries, almost all did. One or two that we weren't sure would make it, of those, one did not, and one did.
Did you have any level of disaster response training prior to 9/11?
So in 1993, we also received hundreds of casualties with the first bombing of the North Tower, which resulted in six deaths at the tower, but hundreds of injuries and hundreds of smoke inhalation cases. So they all came to us. And after 1993, we were pretty diligent about training for disasters and organizing our Code Yellow, we called it, our disaster response mechanisms. So as it turns out, we had a disaster drill July 30th of 2001, so just 6 weeks before the towers were hit.
We're talking with Dr. Tony Daher. He's the chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at New York's Presbyterian Lower Manhattan Hospital. That facility is five blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. He and his team triaged hundreds of victims back on 9/11/01. I have to ask you about the 14 years since then. How have you come to view that day and this chapter from a distance of 14 years?
It's a great question. I think, part of it, in preparing for my talk today at Sparrow, at the Sparrow Foundation, I was talking to some of the folks who were still at the hospital, who were with me on that day. And in many cases, it's obviously hard to talk about. And they'll talk to me because we all shared it. But most of them would say, I haven't spoken about it in years. And it creates a camaraderie and a trust in each other, obviously, that persists 14 years later. We all know that everybody rose to the occasion on that day and still would, as would anyone, I think. I think what 9/11 proved to me was that people will rise to any occasion, and certainly our staff did. But, you try to avoid being too philosophical and thinking about the state of the world and what could have been. I think that for me, the most powerful after feeling in New York City was how tender everyone was with each other, how caring we were with everybody around us. And this is a lot of hard-bitten New Yorkers who generally ignore each other.
Had you been in New York City for long at that point? Well, you were there in 93, so you go back that far.
Yeah, I was born there. Not always raised there, but went to medical school there and have lived there ever since.
What do you have a lasting image or two from that day?
Probably the most powerful image is when we first got our patients, that we heard the plane had hit. We knew it was an airliner. One of our paramedics had gone right to the scene, so we knew it wasn't a small tourist plane or something like that. So we knew it was going to be bad. We scrambled to get all the supplies together, rushing around. We knew we had 5 or 10 minutes at most. And then there was a strange pause where we waited for people to come in. We were at the ambulance bay, and for about 30 seconds, nothing was happening. And we looked at each other thinking, man, false alarm. And suddenly a wave of people came around the corner. So the time it took people to run those five blocks from the towers to our hospital, they came in a wave. It was a tidal wave of people, and I suddenly thought, now what do I do?
What worked well that day? What didn't work well that day?
I think what worked very well was being a small hospital, we all knew each other. So it was very easy to, not easy, but certainly very doable to all coordinate and know who was in charge, who was managing what. Specifically, when I saw that tidal wave of people, I had a large group of young residents and interns with me, and I immediately started assigning them a patient each. As every patient came in, you're supposed to tie tags around their necks and take your time, and there was no time for that. So I just would grab a young doctor, attach them to a patient, tell them to go back and find the proper treatment area for the patient, and then circulate back. So it was matching the people that I had to the people that were coming in worked very well. What I think was very difficult on 9/11 was the coordination on a city level. The command center was taken out when the North Tower went down. The city very unwisely had put its Office of Emergency Management headquarters after the 1993 bombing. They put the headquarters across the street from the North Tower. And that was destroyed in the bombing as well. So the city was leaderless. So a lot of people were trying to set up triage areas and medical treatment areas in our vicinity when we had a fully functioning hospital. Mm. I don't think any harm came of it, but it was not well coordinated.
You're in Lansing today to open up about this experience and talk about it. What has become your routine for September 11th as it rolls around every year? Is it usually a quieter, just more personal thing, or do you have speaking engagements or what?
It's tapered over the years. I think most people prefer to have it be quiet.
Has it become less vivid over 14 years?
It's become more dormant. You can bring it back in all its vividness when you start speaking about it or sharing with other folks. It's just not as all present as it was, obviously in the first few years afterwards.
9/11 was the largest civilian casualty emergency in U.S. history. How was it a learning moment for your entire industry, your entire business, emergency medicine. Were changes made in emergency medicine because of 9/11?
I think so. I think a lot of dogma was challenged, specifically, for instance, treating people at the scene as a bad idea, that evacuation is the most life-saving thing you can do. The miracle of 9/11 is that 99% of the people below the tower's impact sites survived, that the transit police, the fire department, all the rescue workers who got people out of those buildings are the true heroes. They saved thousands of lives by getting people away from the disaster site.
I'm wondering what it's like with your colleagues who were there 14 years ago and you on 9/11. I mean, there must be some exchange between you and the people who are still. How many people are still, do you still work with on a daily basis, who were there 14 years ago?
A couple of dozen. It's still a fair amount.
Still quite a few.
Yeah, still quite a few.
Quite a few. What is that day like for you as a group?
I think it's just, it's a checking in with each other to acknowledge what we went through and to realize that we've been strong comrades ever since, that we'll always have each other's backs, that there is a trust that nobody can ever challenge.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us here today. You're a long way from home, and you're part of a Sparrow Foundation event here later today, and we appreciate your joining us an awful lot. We've been talking with Dr. Tony Daher, Director of Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Lower Manhattan Hospital. Dr. Daher is the keynote speaker at the Sparrow Foundation's annual Kaleidoscope Conference at the Kellogg Center at Michigan State University. Continued success. Thank you for your service, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is Friday, and that makes it a Live Music Friday. Our guest today has been Alex Mendenhall. Alex is a Mason native. He studied here at Michigan State, studied anthropology, as it turns out. And he's been on the local music scene here for quite some time. Let's hear Alex perform "We've Come So Far."
Sitting out on my back porch waiting for the sun to go on down. I can hear the birds singing, I can hear them make their sound. All at once all the pieces shattered by a jet plane overhead. And down the road with the speakers blaring comes a rusty old flatbed. People say that we're making progress and I may stand alone, but to me nothing seems progressive about a selfie and sepia tone. Looking out at the world around us through liquid crystal displays, we don't see how the world is changing. We don't read what the signs say, 'cause there was a time that we lived in harmony, but we can't see the forest 'cause we cut down all the trees. And there was a time that we wished upon a star, but now the city lights are shining. Yet you say we've come so far. Glaciers melting when the sea level on the rise. Mother Nature is begging for help, but we ignore her cries. Will you go on living in our same old human ways? But before we know it, well, it might just be too late. 'Cause there was a time that we lived in harmony, but we can't see the forest 'cause we cut down all the trees. And there was time that we wished upon a star, but now the city lights are shining. And you say we've come so far.
and we lived in harmony. But we can't see the forest, cause we cut down all the trees. And there was a time that we wished upon a star. And now the city lights are shining, yet you say we've come so far.
Alex Mendenhall here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State is called We've Come So Far. Welcome, Alex. Good
Thanks
to meet
for having
you.
Me, Mark.
You sound really good today.
Thank you.
A lot of energy for first thing in the morning. You studied anthropology at Michigan State University. How did anthropology and music, did they coexist comfortably or what?
That was not intentional. I can say that. I started anthropology just because of my love for history, and I didn't start playing music until during my freshman year at MSU, so they just kind of happened separately, and after graduation, I decided that this was my passion, and I've been going for it ever since.
Degree in anthropology, though.
Correct.
What do you do with a degree in anthropology?
Well, it's very broad.
You apply to grad school, right?
You apply to grad school, absolutely. And Michigan State actually has a thing at with the anthropology department where you can't go to grad school here because they want a diversified approach, so you have to go somewhere else.
I did not know that.
Or else I probably would have gone to grad school. So,
But you're throwing everything you've got at music.
Yeah, I am. Yep, I've been doing it full-time for... I quit my job about a year and a half ago, so it's been full-time ever since.
Introduce your rhythm section to us.
Yeah. My drummer here is myself. I do foot percussion. So I've got a cajon that I play with a bass drum pedal, and then a tambourine that I play with another bass drum pedal.
So you watch Alex perform, and basically it's your heels that hit. Well, you got a pedal for each heel.
Correct.
And the left heel hits the cajon, kind of a bass drum, kind of thud. And what's on the right heel?
It's a tambourine.
So I suppose you were a chronic foot tapper probably growing up as a kid, so you had a built-in percussion section just ready to go.
And I was in marching band, so it's kind of like marching in place.
Last month you toured out east for a couple of weeks.
Yep.
You had gigs in New York City. And you had gigs in cottage towns like Chapel Hill and Morgantown, West Virginia. Were they your first solo gigs? Because I know you've been in a band and you've been in a duo before.
Yeah.
Were these your first solo gigs?
I had done solo gigs before I joined the duo Rachel and Alex. So these were my first out-of-state solo gigs and some of the first ones that I'd done in a long time.
Mm-hmm. So now that you've been in a band and you've been in a duo and you've played some solo gigs, you're putting together a band to play your songs for the first time. What's that like?
I've only played with one of the members so far, but I'm excited to hear my music take on a new shape and add some new sounds to it. So this is the first time that I've ever tried to add other members to my band, which is cool.
You were part of Rachel and Alex, and you were part of a band called Coolidge.
Yeah.
What kind of music did Coolidge do?
Coolidge was actually, we are still sort of playing together. It was actually a family band with my stepdad and sister and uncles. So we did a lot of classic rock and oldies, and I played saxophone and accordion and stuff in that. So that was a lot of fun.
But you have had this urge, I guess, to write your own stuff. How many songs have you written so far?
I don't know. I've done two EPs, which were both 8 songs each, and then I'm working on my newest one. So I'd say somewhere around 50, and not all of them are good.
What's that like deciding? Yeah, this belongs on the CD. No, this doesn't belong on the CD.
This is actually the first time that I've written many more songs than I need for a CD. So before I was kind of writing to the CD, and this time I'm trying to write as many good songs as I can, and then pick the best to be on the CD. Which
you
I
must
think is a
really
better idea.
Have to be critical, though.
Yes.
I mean, in a way, they're all your babies.
Right.
But you gotta say, yeah, you're a keeper, and you're not.
And some of that just comes from playing songs out and hearing how crowds respond.
Alex Mendenhall has been joining us here. He's been providing the live music here on Current State's Live Music Friday. Tonight, see and hear Alex perform at Fabiano's Riverhouse Grill in Portland. He'll also sing at the Foods for Living tent sale in East Lansing on Sunday. Alex Mendenhall will play us out here in just a few minutes after I remind all of our listeners that Monday we get updated on the UAW contract talks with the Detroit Three. What does the future hold for those talks? GM, Ford, Chrysler, and the UAW. The Detroit News' Daniel Howes checks in with his thoughts Monday here on Current State. We want to thank our entire staff for a show that was largely put together here in the last hour or two before we hit the air today because of everything that was going on at the state capitol. Peter Wharf, April Van Buren, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. We hope to see you Monday. Alex Mendenhall plays us out on WKAR's Current State.
From a dream with a tug in my sleeve, I felt someone there from the chill in the air. A whisper caught my ear, and the voice was quite clear. I heard it was so close. It was the sound of your ghost.